Good afternoon, Rabosai. Be'ez Hashem will begin the Chazara for 2017 fall semester contemporary halacha. My goal today is to not just review all the different shiurim, but hopefully organize them in your mind, break them down, each shiur into its, you know, three or four or five main topics that you could just have an easier way to attack each shiur and swallow up each shiur. And I think we'll go in just in the order that the shiurim were given. We might, if I or you are tired, we might take a break in the middle, because it's going to be a little bit intense right now, because I'm going to move very quickly, hopefully without much interruption. If you want to talk, if you have questions, please ask the questions to me another time. But now we just want to maximize. We have a huge amount to cover in the next hour and a half, which probably won't be enough. So we'll try to have some other time to fill that in. So we're going to begin with Rabbi Neuberger's shiur on Hilchos Yom Tov. Halachas of Yom Tov start with gas stoves. So first of all, lighting fires is mutter midaraisa on Yom Tov. It's asur midarabanan. There's machlokas rishonim. Why? It's asur to be molid eish. That is, according to the Rambam, it's because the sun that's iyashala soso meesma. I'm sorry. The things that are asur are things that are iyashala. Things that are mutter are things that are iyashala soso meesma. But if sun that's eshala soso meesma, like, for example, lighting a fire, that should be done before Yom Tov. So therefore, it's going to be also drabana. Rashi and Tosfos hold no. It's a totally different iser. It's mutter to do even if you could have done it yesterday. What makes it aser is the fact that it's being molded. A new iser drabanan called molded that Rashi is mechadesh, and that's why you're not allowed to light a fire, ignite a fire anew, midrabanan on Yom Tov. That comes to practical application as far as pilot lights, which is again going out of fashion really fast. But those who still have old ovens with pilot lights, you're allowed to be mamshech. If you have a pilot light, you could turn on the flame on your oven or your stovetop because the pilot light's already on. You're just being mamshech the flame. You're not being molded or you're not creating a new flame, and that would be okay. The problem is nowadays, almost all of us have electric ignition, which is being madlik, a flame, and that's going to be there for us to turn on an oven or a stovetop on with an electric ignition on Yom Tov. Similarly, even if you have a heating element that, you know, that's an electric element, presumably when you turn the certain kind of electric element, sometimes you're turning on new, if you turn from 250 to 350, that itself might be using a different circuit entirely. It might not just be increasing the electricity in it, it might be entirely an entirely new circuit. So that also could be a problem in those kinds of electric ovens. What about lowering food? We'll talk about lowering flames in a minute, actually. We'll hold it for now. Let's talk about Shabbos Mod Oven. Shabbos Mod Oven that Rav Heinemann engineered have three aspects, two which are wonderful and one which has not been accepted by the poskim. Number one is that there's no 12-hour cutoff, so you could use it effectively over a 2 or 3 day Yom Tov. That's wonderful. Another thing is that there's if you open up the oven, the lights don't go on, the fan doesn't go on, there are no electric readouts. That's wonderful. The problem that the poskim have is with the third option, and that the third aspect of what a Shabbos Mod Oven does, and that's Heinemann engineered an oven to work, the Shabbos Mod Oven to work like this. The digital display is off already, but if you press it on Yom Tov, the oven will not react to your pressing the button, but rather it will store that information in its brain, and then there will be some kind of cycle, and it will get, when it realizes in its internal cycle, a quarter of a second later, maybe a second and a half later, that, oh, there's been a change in the status quo, then it will register and cause whatever inputted command to register. That Heinemann considers to be grammar. And the post can take issue with that. Why would theoretically grammar be okay? Because we just said a moment ago that lighting a fire on Shabbos is only nisr drabanan. And here it's a gram of nisr drabanan. Letzorach Yom Tov, so if you have a gramma on a drabanan, letzorach ochel nefesh, that would be mutter. That's what Heinemann suggests. The problem that we have, the problem the post can have, is that that's not called gramma. Gramma has to be, if you have a system that's set up to do this, and then something else will happen, next step it will happen, that's not called grama. Grama has to have some element of koach acher me'urav bo, some element of, you don't know if it's going to happen or not, That's what grammar would be called. But if it's just a setup, it built in that this is how it works, that's not sufficient to be called grammar. Let's go to the next point. The next point will be opening the door of an oven on Yontif and on Shabbos. Let's talk about Shabbos first. Could you open an oven door on Shabbos? So when Neuberger gave the shir, he said absolutely not, because when you open the, let's say the oven right now is not lit. Let's say the fire is off, and you open the door, what happens very quickly? Cold air rushes in, the thermostat realizes that the temperature is dropping, and the thermostat right away turns the oven back on. So therefore, Rabbi Neuberger said, you're not allowed to open an oven door, or a warming drawer, that will be a psik reik. You're not doing a malachi, you're doing a psik reik, you're opening the oven door to get the food, and that's going to cause the fire to go back on. Between you and me, Rabbi Willig does not hold from that opinion of Rabbi Neuberger, and Rabbi Schefter, Rabbi Neuberger and Rabbi Schefter are in the same camp, but Rabbi Willig is of the opinion that no, in the same way you could open up a door to your house, and we're not worried that your air conditioner and your heater is going to instantly pop open, because it doesn't happen quickly enough, it's not starkly enough of a difference of the temperature differential, therefore you could open, the same way you could open the door of a house, even during the winter, during the summer, so to Rabbi Willig holds, it's really the chalukas of Metzias, as it comes out to be. But Willig assumes when you open up the door of an oven, it's not going to cause the fire to go on right away, and therefore, Rabbi Willig holds, you can open up the oven on Shabbos, even if that wouldn't be considered a psik resha. However, when it comes to Yontif, everybody agrees that it's going to be okay. Why? Because again, lighting a fire, which is the worst thing that could happen, is only nesed rabbanon. So let's put everything together. It's a psik resha. On an issue rabbanon with tzorech ochal nefesh, again that would be mutter. Psik resha on a rabbanon tzorech mitzah would be mutter.
With respect to that particular point, isn't it not a rabbanon kal though? Even though you're talking about the
let's move on. When we talk about goy turi on the naven on yantif, so we could potentially engineer a situation, only because we're just very tight in time, we're not going to have enough time even as it is. We could potentially talk about the heter of a shvus to shvuch b'makom mitzvah. But again, we're talking about a guy turning the oven on for you on Yontif. So if you just want to save money, and that's why you didn't leave your oven on for 2 or 3 days, so that's not a makom mitzvah. So you have no right to do the shvus, tell the guy. The shvus to turn on a fire on Yontif, which we said again 3 times already that it's only nesed rabbanon, that's no makom mitzvah if you're just trying to do it to save the money. However, if you don't want to leave an oven on because it's going to be unsafe, or if it's going to be hot in the kitchen, like on Shavuot's time, so it's going to be, that's cool, that would be considered a makom mitzvah, so then we could put everything together. We have a shvus of Amir Lenachri, the shvus for turning on a fire on Yontif, but makom mitzvah because you don't want to be comfortable to over Yontif and safe over Yontif, then it would be permitted to ask a guy. This shiloh happens all the time, by the way. I must have gotten it 5 times over Sukkos. You could ask a guy to turn your oven on Yontif if you have these situations, again, for safety, that you're not leaving on for safety or for heat in the kitchen. Let's go to the next point. The next point is, what about lowering a flame on Yontif? So, in general, it is aser to lower a flame on Yontif. The same way you can't, it's not for ochel nefesh, and it's asur lower flame. What happens if it is for ochel nefesh? So then, it's going to only be mutter to the extent that it's for ochel nefesh. So meaning, if there's a pot that you don't want to keep on the flame, on such a high flame, so guess what? Take it off the flame. Don't touch the knob. However, if it's something, the kind of food that needs to stay on the flame for a long time, and if you leave it on the type of flame that it's on now, the height of the flame that it's on now, it will end up getting burnt, not just a little drier, not just a little crispier, but it will really be significantly worse. Then the poskim say that would be considered tzorech ochel nefesh, and it would be permitted even to lower a flame, the tzorech ochel nefesh. If it's just that you want to keep it on low because you don't want it so hot, that itself is not enough to warrant lowering a flame. Let's say you... Okay. Ramosha did have a kula that allows turning off a flame, but unless you're from the Lower East Side, that kula is not relied upon. If you're from the Lower East Side, then it's speak to him. Next, let's talk about Yom Tov Sheni. Yom Tov Sheni, the minhag of Klal Yisrael for the past 1,000+ years, was that foreigners who visit Eretz Yisrael keep 2 days of Yom Tov when they visit Eretz Yisrael. The reason for that is, as the Shulchan Aruch paskins, that we know that Yom Tov Sheni is Hizaru b'minhag of Yisrei Chav Yadeichem, it's a din minhag. And the Shulchan Aruch tells us that as far as the parameters of a minhag for somebody going to a new place, we follow minhag makom sheyatzel lishat misham. And therefore, if I'm an American and I have a minhag to keep 2 days, and I visit Israel, so minhag makom sheyatzel misham America is to keep 2 days even when I'm in Eretz Israel. So where does the whole Taharam begin? It comes from the Chacham Tzvi. The Chacham Tzvi has a tremendous chiddush that has pretty much not been accepted for most of history, other than perhaps the last 20 years. But the Chacham Tzvi says the following. The Chacham Tzvi says, when he has a limitation in the din of minhag makom sheyatzel misham, says the Chacham Tzvi, when do we say that you follow minhag makom sheyatzel misham? Only if that minhag makom sheyatzel misham is something that if you do it in the new place, will not end up causing more kulas. You're trying to follow minhag makom sheyatzel misham to be more from, not if it's going to be at the expense of, for example, a brach levatala, or at the expense of, for example, Bal Tosef, both of which could be problems if you would do it in Eretz Yisrael. So if you do minhag makom sheyatzel misham in the new place where it won't cause any problems, then you do minhag makom sheyatzel misham. But here, in going to Eretz Yisrael, we're doing the minhag makom sheyatzel misham, the second day of Yom Tov, could cause potential problems. You couldn't continue that minhag if you would move to Eretz Yisrael. It would be Bal Tosef, it would be Baruch HaVatala. There, the whole din of minhag makom sheyatzel misham wouldn't apply. That's the chiddush of the Chacham Tzvi. And of course, that has not been accepted by the poskim, including some of you have the Ivitz. Anyone know what the Ivitz stands for? Yaakov Emden Ben Tzvi. Who is his father? The Chacham Tzvi, his own son, did not accept his father's kula. And Rabbi Yashiv said the Chacham Tzvi can't even be mitzuruf as a snif lahakel, bitzer of shitas. Even that he wasn't willing to do. Someone says no, you could use that as a tzir for makom l'safek. Anyway, that's halacha. As far as halacha maisa, you'll notice that many rabbis, especially rabbis who are viewed as being tzioni, might have, by their congregations, I should say, might have other opinions. This is typically the minhag, this is the Moshe's psak that typically has been the case. And Rabbanim, as you will become Rabbanim, you'll be under a lot of pressure, and you should work out the sugya and rule based on what you think the sugya says, not what your Baal Batim necessarily want to hear. I will tell you, I did once get a kula from Rav Schachter, who typically says that you do 2 days, typically. The situation was that a girl who's a single girl who's immediate family, not cousins. In fact, the question is always about the cousins and the uncles. It's always the shayla, and that I tell them, you keep 2 days. But her shayla was that her family had made aliyah, they came back, they still had their house, and they go regularly, and their rav said that they could keep 1 day. She's going to be with, again, not her extended relatives, but her immediate relatives, her father, her mother, her brother, her sister, and they were all keeping 1 day. So there, Rav Schachter told me that there would be an issue of los iskodidu, if she would keep a second day, and she should not keep a second day. So that was a fascinating. Even if Shatan only holds 2 days, that was the case that he told me of halach l'maisa, so I had to keep 1 day. But so again, work out the sugya. Let's talk about the next point. The next point will be showering on Yom Tov. Why are you allowed, or what's the issue with showering on Yom Tov? Well, the heter of, the reason why you're allowed to do tzorech l'chol nefesh on Yom Tov is because food is something that's shavet l'chol nefesh. The question is showering equally something that's shavet l'chol nefesh? If it is, great, you could boil up water for showering. If it's not, then boiling up water would be an issur d'oraisa. Yes, if you boil up something that's not the Torah Chol Nefesh, like for example, for a non-Jewish person, for something that's not for food, for an animal that also is not qualified as Chol Nefesh, all those cookings on Yom Tov would be an issur d'oraisa. It's not the Torah Chol Nefesh. So do we consider, everyone considers washing your hands, face, and feet, that's considered Chol Nefesh, that's Shavu Chol Nefesh, and everybody wants hot water for that, so you're allowed to wash your face in hot water, your hands in hot water on Yom Tov. The question is, what about the rest of your body? So, you have, again, whenever you turn on the hot water in your tap, you have not an active bishul, not a maisa bishul, but a psik resha bishul, because when you take the hot water out, new cold water is coming into the tank in your basement, and it's being boiled up, so that's going to be a psik resha on bishul shalot tzarchel chunafesh. And then there's a totally other issue that even if you have hot water, you know, in a pot, there's still a separate issue of gzeres habalonim, which is the nisid rabban not to go to the merchatz because of the historical, the story in the Gemara, the historical dishonesty of the balonim. And Rabbi Neuberg has suggested that if we mitzarif a few kulas altogether, then we could possibly come out with a heter to permit somebody on Yontif Sheni, who is mitzta'er, to shower with lukewarm water. Let's go through the tzeirufim that are necessary to rely on that kula. First of all, Gzeres HaBalanim has a machlokas whether it's only on Shabbos or even on Yontif. Most Rishonim are machlokas that it's on both. That the Yudin applies to Yontif Sheni. But there are some who say, no, maybe it doesn't apply to Yontif. Then you have, that's one tzeiruf. Then you have the fact that it's Yontif Sheni. That's another tzeiruf. Then there are those who say that if somebody is bitzar, that makes it, that is a chalas shem din of ochel nefesh. Meaning we could argue all day long, is it shavel ochel nefesh to shower today? Who raised your hand if you showered this morning? Don't. So I'm saying, is it mom is shavel ochel nefesh to shower every day? Okay, we could discuss it. But I think it was a chasim sofer who said that something would bring because tzar, that everybody would hold is a din of shavel ochel nefesh. So you have that additional kula. Then you have machlokas that we just mentioned, that maybe gzeres habalonim might not apply to yontif. There's another machlokas that maybe gzeres habalonim only applies to a bathtub, not to a shower. There's another machlokas whether gzeres habalonim is limited only to hot water, but not to cooler water. So if you put all these things together, you have a real tzar, and it's yontif shein, which is only derabbanan. And usually we're not mitzarif kulas for yontif shein being derabbanan, but here they're enough to. And it's only lukewarm water. Then Rabbi Neuberg would be willing to be meikel if that's in that situation. However, the goal should be, let's say again, it's a Thursday, Friday, Shabbos situation. You shouldn't take that shower on Friday afternoon, 20 minutes before Shabbos, because then there's no way that the part of it is yet you also want the hot water to be able to, the new water that's coming in that's being mevushel should be at least available for yontif consumption. If you shower at 20 minutes before Shkia, the water, 10 minutes before Shkia, the water that's coming to the boiler might not be ready in time to be used on Yontif, so that would be more like a Hachana type of concern, so it should be done earlier in the day on Friday of a 3-day Yontif. That is the shir on, that was the first shir. Let's go to the next shir. The next shir was Rabbi Neuberger's shir on fasting on Yom Kippur. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam shenekol nidah b'ra'am. This is a very important shir. First of all, Rabbanim have to know that you have to have the halachas ready before Yom Kippur. You can't sit down on Yom Kippur and a lady or a man come over to you and say, I feel like XYZ, or my doctor said, you have to prepare, before, you better do that. And if a person in a shul doesn't ask a shaila in Rako Pikuach Nefesh, the Yushami says that the Rav is held accountable, that he didn't teach his congregation that they should know, that they don't have to ask the shaila. So it's a tremendous achrayus on you when you will become rabbanim. So make sure you teach your congregants that safik pikuach nefesh. You are careful with. Let's talk about a regular healthy meuberes. The Shulchan Aruch says explicitly. And let me back up. The Mishnah says explicitly that a meuberes fasts on Yom Kippur. Nowadays, doctors are very wary, and doctors are certainly very wary of their own malpractice concerns. So they're very quick to say that, to scare women to think that, it's very dangerous. Not saying it's not, but you just have to be aware of which doctor you speak to. So it's very important to have a doctor that you could speak with and a doctor who understands severity, and you don't always have to ask the doctor what should we do. You have to ask, we know what the halacha is. Halacha is a pregnant woman fasts. What you could ask the doctor is this woman at hand significantly different than a regular woman because of her unique situation? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I had a shayla last year, a woman who had a previous one or two miscarriages. So she called, she fasted. I called her, I got her OBG, and her OBG said the fact that she had whatever experience she had, miscarriage, something else, will have absolutely no impact on whether she fasts or not. It has nothing to do with, okay, if you want to fast or not, that's a different question. But that her unique situation makes her no different as far as fasting. So I said, okay, so you're regular, as far as this is concerned, you're a regular Mu'ubaris. Who was Mekel in a Mu'ubaris? That's Dayan Fisher, Yaakov Yisrael Fisher. And he said in a Hakdama, in one of his Haskamas to a different Sefer, he wrote there that, again, I think Neuberger mentioned that Dayan Fisher was a very beloved posek, especially by women. Not because of his great looks, maybe they were, but because he had great kulas for fasting for women, and before Yom Kippur, the line would be, he had slots in the Beis Din, in the Badatz, in the Merkaz Hara, and there would be like a 2 hour, like a 2 block line out the door of women lining up specifically when he was sitting in the Beis Din. People wanted to get his kulas. So he says that nowadays no Mu'ubaris should fast Yom Kippur because it's Chalishas Hadoros, and many people have been Mapilo, so therefore all women should eat less than a shear. So the Tzitz Eliezer rejects this Shita, many of the poskim rejected the Shita, but the Tzitz Eliezer outlines 3 areas of weakness in this argument. The first area of weakness is that the data might be wrong. And the data might be wrong for a number of reasons. Firstly, the data might be wrong because you say that Nechlesh Adoros were weaker now. To the contrary, chances are our pregnant women are better nourished and have better nutrition than any generation previously. Secondly, another reason you think that the data might be wrong is that we have studies that show that there's a meaningless, a statistically insignificant change in terms of women giving birth before full term. Because of fasting, and even if there is some increase in giving birth, but it's not something that has caused danger. So pretty much there is not even a concern, even based on statistical studies. Thirdly, maybe your data might be wrong because even when you said that there are many women who had hapalos, miscarriages, well, maybe that was including the people who shouldn't have fasted the first place because they had general health issues. So those are all reasons why Dayan Fisher's data might be wrong. Secondly, another argument would be based on the Maharam Sheikh. We know that a svek svek sveka if pikach nefesh remachmir. But if there's 1 in 1 million chance, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000, 1 in 1 million, that's also called a svek svek sveka. You have to know. At some point, if something is statistically insignificant, that will be enough for us to say that's not called a Safik Pikuach Nefesh. So it's true that if there would be a Safik Pikuach Nefesh, we would be allow the person to eat. But it shouldn't be. Presumably the numbers aren't enough that it's statistically significant that would be called a Safik Pikuach Nefesh. And thirdly, you're saying Nishtanu HaTvayim. It's an explicit Mishnah. It's an explicit Shulchan Aruch. You're going to say Nishtanu HaTvayim without getting, you know, at least a good amount of Gedolei Yisrael together to decide that, that's just a difficult thing to do, and therefore, those are the 3 arguments that the Tzitz Eliezer put forth to reject. I don't remember if it's the Tzitz Eliezer or Beit Bleich put forth to reject Dayan Fisher's Kula. That's the first point. Let's go to situations where, this is the next point, we're going to now talk about scenarios where a pregnant woman would break her fast, where we are concerned that she not fast on Yom Kippur. Keep in mind that when we speak about health of a pregnant woman, we are equally concerned with the life of the mother as with the life of the unborn fetus, even below 40 days. A 1 day old, a 1 day after conception fetus, if you want to call it a fetus or a blastocyte, whatever you want to call it, that is equally reason to be Mechalel Shabbos Daraisa, to go to the hospital. That is equally reason to eat Achiv Kares of eating on Yom Kippur to save either mother or that fetus, that unborn fetus. That's important to keep in mind. So what are some scenarios? Scenario number 1, if there are 2 undiagnosed miscarriages or any miscarriage that potentially might be correlated to dehydration or to fasting, that would be a reason for her now to eat. Number 2, if for whatever reason she's at risk for preterm delivery. Again, these are all discussions that can be had with the doctor and should be had with the doctor. Number 3, if she's already, you know, later in her pregnancy and has preterm labor pains, and we're worried that it's not at a point that she should be giving birth yet. It's only like the 7th or 8th month, and she already has labor pains that might, you know, this might egg things on, that could be a concern. Number four, some women, even if it's not, even when they're not pregnant, and even when they're not fasting, they have issues with dehydration. You have such a, you know, such a person who, I remember, we had a summer program for the JSS students years ago. On Tisha B'Av, I remember very vividly. Tisha B'Av, we book Yad Vashem, because it's a great thing to do on Tisha B'Av. It's very appropriate. I remember there was a young lady on our program. She was very, 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 very petite, very small. And I remember she, like, it was 1 in the afternoon. It wasn't even, like, you know, 4 or 5 in the afternoon. I remember she was, like, walking towards the end of Yad Vashem, and she just collapsed. So, you know, and I think she called me, and then, like, she got married a year or two later. She was in my, so probably, like, a year or two later, I think she called me about, you know, fasting on Yom Kippur. I'm like, I remember you. I've seen you before. I don't know, whatever, it was on the phone. But, yeah, somebody who has, in general, dehydration issues, so if they're fasting and they're pregnant, then you have to be aware of that. In terms of a person who vomited, so if a woman vomited, again, how to make this cutoff, I'm not sure, but whoever did the research, that vomiting 2 times is not necessarily a risk for dehydration, but vomiting 3 times does put a person at a risk for dehydration, then again, should eat. Then, in general, let's say on Yom Kippur, the individual shows signs of dehydration for whatever reason, without any pre-existing conditions. Any person, not just this halach is not just for mu'uberes. Any person who has indications and symptoms of dehydration is a pikuach nefesh for anybody, not just for mu'uberes. It's more heightened for mu'uberes, but for any person, there's a risk of dehydration. Another, we'll talk about what are the signs of dehydration. Some signs of dehydration might be contraction. If you're pregnant, contractions. If you're not pregnant, then you have contractions. There are other issues. But a sign of dehydration that anybody could be suffering, that you should tell them they should begin to drink, would be an extraordinarily bad headache. Not a regular, you know, we all get headaches, but a unique dehydration headache, heart palpitations, faintness, dizziness. If you're dizzy when you get up, I have a solution. Don't get up. Stay down, and then you won't be dizzy. But if you, even when you're staying down, you're dizzy, so that is a symptom of dehydration. That person should eat. For muberes, if there's a lack of fetal movement, they feel the baby kicking. All of a sudden, you know, Kip in the afternoon at 2, 3 o'clock, she hasn't felt anything for an hour and a half. So that happens. And these things, you know, those things come up. So those would be cases when a person should begin to drink. In the ninth month.
Is this still drinking below the amount of the shiur?
We'll talk about shiurim shortly. In the ninth month, let's say she starts getting labor pain, she starts feeling contractions in the ninth month. So there's two ways to look at it. Great, let her have the baby. What's the problem? You're worried that she's going to have a baby? Good, let it come out. The other concern is that, but she has to have energy to push out the baby. So this is a machlokas. Diane Fisher, who was Makel before, right? He says that women could drink. He says, no. If she's in the ninth month, she's in labor anyway, so why is she eating now? Well, the whole point is to prevent her from going to labor early, right? The body builds a woman that if the baby is not safe inside, the body pushes it out. But if the body could push it out, it's in the ninth month, so let the baby be born. So Diane Fisher's machmir in the ninth month. But Evansal says, no, but she has to have strength to give birth. It's not an easy process. So Rabbi Neuberger likes to have like a sort of a pshara. If, you know, 9:30 at night, 2-3 hours after Sukkot Sanos Sekes, you know, she has labor pains, you know, she just ate a gigantic meal 3 hours ago. So why eat now? On the other hand, if it's 4 o'clock on Yom Kippur in the afternoon, she hasn't eaten in 21 hours, so then that would be a time for her to, yes, eat to have energy to give birth. Let's talk about when a person has to eat, how to do it. So we just finished all the cases where a pregnant woman would drink, would eat, mostly drinking. We're not really concerned about eating. We're mostly concerned about drinking. But let's talk about how to drink. When there's a person who does have to drink, so we have to have some parameters. First of all, it's a very important chasen sofer. I had a terrible experience this year. Terrible experience. A woman called me and she was convinced that if she didn't eat on Yom Kippur, she would drop dead because she's in a near-starvation situation all year long. So I spoke to 3 doctors. I spoke to a endocrinologist, gastroenterologist, and a respected internist. The Sveta internist said, there's nothing to worry about. The gastroenterologist said, send her to a psychiatrist. And the endocrinologist said, send her to a psychologist. So it was in her mind. I had such a difficult time trying to tell her that I know you feel like you're going to die. Again, there is this sugya elsewhere that Yodea Maras Nafsho, people know when they're going to die. They have the right to determine that. But, you know, every doctor, because it wasn't drinking. You know, she needed to have a granola bar or something. She had to have solid food. And every doctor I spoke to said, you only die from starvation after, do you know how long it takes to die from starvation?
Four weeks.
To die from starvation. Not that anyone should die. But if you go 4 weeks, that's when, you know, you die from starvation after 3 or 4 weeks. You know, that's what we're worried about. The issue is only, again, they're not talking about a pregnant woman. She wasn't pregnant. Stama, you know, she just happened to be that, you know. Fine. So I had a very difficult time convincing her that she has to fat. More than that, this is the conversation. So if you want to set yourself up for success, stay home. But Rabbi, that goes against everything I ever learned about Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is about tshuva. Yom Kippur is about, you know, davening. And now you tell me to stay home. All the years of day school told me everything not like that. How can you tell me that I should stay home? Sorry, lady. They forgot to teach you this chasm sofer. Okay? Yes, you have to. It's very difficult. This is a pastoral issue. You have to convince people that they're, and with pregnant, first pregnancies also, you have to convince them they should stay home, they should miss all of Yom Kippur, stay in bed, sleep the entire Yom Kippur. Don't worry, you could believe in it. Kedushat Hayom is Mechaper. Believe in that. You could say a Vidui for 10 seconds and sleep the rest of the day, Mamash. And that's better than Chas V'Shalom, even having to have one Chatzi Shir. I will now say what is the most important point for the entire semester. There are a lot of people who think that Chatzi Shir is only Asur D'Rabbanan. It is not. Chatzi Shir is Asur HaTorah. That means somebody wants to take the tiniest sip or the tiniest bite. Lots of people think that if they don't feel good, they could do that. If they're weak, they could do that. That's not correct. That is a lie. A lot of people think that. A lot of people, even people who are religious and even people who are somewhat learned, because it's the learned people who heard the term called Chatzi Shir. When a person has, Rav Shlomo Zalman says that if a person could, let's say, stay in bed all day and thereby prevent the need for having even one Chatzi Shir, let's say over the course of the day they're going to need it for health reasons, 8 Chatzi Shirs. And if they stay in bed, they will only need 7 Chatzi Shirs. Rav Shlomo Zalman says they have to stay in bed all day long to avoid having that 8th Chatzi Shir on Yom Kippur. Okay, so what is a Chatzi Shir? So Chatzi Shir is, the easiest way to assume, is those mini schnapps glasses, not the shot glasses. They're 1 ounce shot glasses, like the plastic ones in shul, and the 2 ounce glasses of the people who know how to drink when they drink scotch. So the 1 ounce ones, that's the easiest thing to use. Again, the shir is not really that, but as far as convenience, and that should be once every lechatchila 9 minutes. The different shirim is what's kedei. So start to be, if you assume once every 9 minutes, if that's not enough, once every 7 minutes, if that's not enough, once every 6 minutes, if that's not enough, once every 4 minutes. All different shitas of the shiur of Kedei Achilas Pras. If a person is, let's talk about some of the doctor's orders. If a person, if the doctor says she could fast, but if she gets dehydrated, she's going to have to drink a lot. Which really, that's a real shot. It happens quite often. Doctor says, there's nothing wrong with fasting, but if she does get dehydrated, she's going to have to drink properly. So, what should you do? So, Rabbi Neuberger said that if there is a chance that she will be able to make it through the whole fast, that she should not drink at all, even a pachat yishir. If, however, if she starts out not drinking at all, she will definitely have to drink a lot later. Then it's better to try to have a whole day of Chatzi Shirs, if she's definitely going to have to drink at some point. Better to have a whole day of Chatzi Shirs than even one time having to have a full Shir. You should start the day with Shir. Okay, let's go to the next point. What about a woman who's nursing? Did I say Shahakla yet?
Yes.
Okay, great. No, I believe you. Let's talk about a woman who's nursing. So, Shulchan Aruch says nursing women should fast, but it's not always so easy. Sometimes nursing women are more agitated about their nursing than pregnant women, because it's a real baby that they're, you know, dealing with. So, what you should do is encourage people 2 weeks before Yom Kippur to ask you the shilas about medicines and about nursing and all that, so that if a nursing woman calls you 2 weeks before, you can say, great, you have 2 weeks, start training your baby to drink a bottle. And nursing women could pump their own mother's milk into little bags, put it in the freezer, and this way they'll have a store of milk available from their own milk, from their own body, you know, for the baby. But you have to get the baby able to nurse from a bottle. So that takes time to sometimes get it. If they don't have milk and they called you Erev Yom Kippur, so, you know, you can't make them feel too bad at this point, but you call them back 2 weeks before next Yom Kippur and make them feel bad about the last Yom Kippur. So then, I'm sorry, lady, you'll want to give your baby only mother's milk, but at this point you're going to have to try to give your baby formula. Sometimes you have a situation where you have a lot of things. The baby doesn't want to take a bottle. And the baby, the mother doesn't have milk to give. And the baby's getting aggravated. And there's many hours left till the end of Yom Kippur. So in that case, that would be the only real situation where we'd allow a nursing woman to drink on Yom Kippur. But if it's, I'm assuming it's a healthy baby. We're not talking about health issues. But if it's a new baby who never took the formula, and the mother's worried, and I've had these conversations, that, my lactation specialist or doctor said, if I don't nurse for a full day, then I might lose my milk. So the halacha is, okay, I'm sorry, feel bad, it is definitely good for what baby to have mother's milk, but not at the risk of violating the kares of Yom Kippur. Fine.
She can nurse and drink.
If she can nurse and drink, that's ideal. But sometimes there's no milk if she doesn't drink. By the end of the latter part of the day, there might not be milk. That's when she'll definitely be more prone to dehydrate. But what you tell her before Yantav is that don't worry about trying to nurse and losing liquids on Yom Kippur. Use milk that you were able to express, 2 weeks before Yom Kippur, a week before Yom Kippur, and keep it in the fridge or the freezer. Okay, let's go to the next year. The next year is Hilchas Dal Minim. I hope you understand why I didn't want to take questions before. Okay, Hilchas Dal Minim, Rabbi Konigsberg. So the first halacha when it comes to Esrog is that it can't be a Murkav. Why not? Well, the Magen Rav says, if it's Murkav, it's not an Esrog. The Levush says a different story. He says, no, because being Markiv is an Isser to be Markiv, so it's like a Mitzvah Abba Baveir. Interesting, Yishmak Alam is there. When it comes to the simanim, the definition of an esrog, so the Gemara tells us, the Shulchan Aruch says, that the Rama says there are four simanim to assure something's an esrog, either blitos, the ukatzis shakua, klipa ava, the seeds are whatever, in a certain direction, vertical. The Chasam Sofer says that nowadays you shouldn't really rely on those simanim, but rather you have to have a besorah on that pardes. So this is one case where the badatz, the charedis is meiko. But that's the Chareis is Mekel to rely on the Rama, who says that any Esrog or Esrog Pardes or Esrog tree that has these simanim, you could assume is a kosher Esrog. Chasam said that's a bit cooler, because, that doesn't mean that it was never grafted, but the Chasam Sofer doesn't like that. If you go to a guy, a Mocher Esrog, and he says, you say, what Hashgav does it have on these Esrog? He says, but that's the Chareis. So normally you say, terrific, let me have, when it comes to Esrogim, there might be those who are not going to be impressed with that response. Let's talk about some psulim of an esrog. First of all, Mishnah tells us that natla pitmaso is pasul. However, nitla shashanta, that little ball on top of the stem, that's kosher. And it's only going to be pasul if the stem under the shashanta also falls off. That's when it's pasul. So the question is, how much of the stem has to fall off to be pasul? So there's machlokas. The Taz says that so much of the stem has to fall off that there's mamsha hole there. That's a big kula. Others a machmir, even if it was part of the stem fell off, it's a problem. And there's a middle sheet that says the whole stem has to fall off, it's going to be possible even if there's no hole. That's machlokas. So the Mishnah Berurah is make of just the shashanta fell off, just that top ball, right? Everyone's worried, oh my gosh, you're going to drop the esrog, right? So let's see what happens. The top of the esrog falls off. The top of the shashan, the little ball on top falls off. Mishmur says, go ahead, use it even on the first day. If you have a mehudar esrog, better to use the mehudar esrog that the top of the shashan fell off, rather than borrow somebody else's, even on the first day where there's an inyan of lachem. However, if part of the stem fell off, then they were going to be concerned with a chisaron of likichatama and should be avoided on the first day. But of course, after the first day, since the concern of chaser is only a psil on the first day, even if it did fall off, even if a big chunk did fall off, that would be okay because there's no isra, there's no psil of chaser beyond the first day. Now, let's talk about other psul, which are going to be psul of hadar, not of chaser, but of hadar. Hadar is machlokas if it applies only on the first day, like chaser, or it extends and the psul of hadar applies even to the rest of the 7 days. The Rambam says that no, hadar doesn't apply on the rest of the 7 days. Hadar is just like chaser. Hadar and chaser, according to the Rambam, are only on the first day. And the psulim don't apply, psulim of hadar don't apply to the other days. So this actually is machlokes Shulchan Aruch and Rambam. The Shulchan Aruch is make like the Rambam, that both psuls of chaser and the psul of hadar are only on the first day. And the Rambam is machmir and says that although chaser is only on the first day, hadar will extend indeed to the rest of the 7 days. So let's think for a minute. If you have if the pitum falls off, this is a machlokas. Some say that the psul of a nitla pitmaso is not a palm of chasa, but it's a palm of hadar. So let's think for a second. The Mishnah Berurah says that you would be allowed to use a eser that had the pitum fall off and the rest of the sukkahs. Why? You have a sfek sveka. Sfek that maybe the concern is only chaser. And chaser is clearly only on the first day. And even if we're worried that nitla pitmaso is a psul of hadar, well, we have a machlokas if hadar only applies in the first year or the seventh, or all 7 days. So you have a sfek sveka that would therefore allow you, maybe it's only psul chaser, which is okay on the rest of the days. And even if it's a psul hadar, maybe we pass in like the Rambam, who says that hadar is only on the first day, and therefore you'd be able to have, use a esrog whose pitum fell off, entire pitum fell off, even if the stem fell off, on the rest of the days, the latter 6 days of it. So let's go to the next point. What about a shiri mara? So Gemara tells us that a chazazis on mi'uto is kosher. A discoloration of a chazaz might be more, it's more like a blistery discoloration. So mi'uto is kosher, rubo is pasal. But the Gemara says if it's two or three places, then it will be pasal, not because it's considered rov, because that would make it menumer, spotted like a leopard. Namer is a red leopard, right? So menumer is leoparded, spotted like a leopard. So the Rosh applies this problem not just to chazazes, but even to black or white, which are also not maros of an esrog. And the psul would be, the Rosh limits it, that if you have, let's say, two or three dots, it's not just two or three dots are a problem. It's two or three dots. If you connect the dots, and that connected dots cover the majority of the surface area of the esrog, that's when, or the majority of the circumference of the esrog, that's when there will be a psul of shinui mara. But if just have two or three dots right next to each other, even though there are two or three dots of shinui mara, that won't be a problem. When you have a shinui mara, like a black dot, a white dot, chazazis, then we're more machmir on the chotem. Chotem afil b'mashu is pasul. What is a chotem? Three-way machloka. There are at least three shittas, if not more, about what the chotem is. It is just the very, very, very top under the stem. Is it the entire incline from where it begins to slope upwards, or is it only the line where the slope begins, like if it's going up straight and then the slope starts, that line, that vertex where it's going straight up and then it starts to slope upwards, only that line is called the chotem. We, the Chasam Sofer, follows what we generally assume, that once it starts sloping upwards, that entire area, which is a chumrah because it's a large area, that even a mashahu of a shinui mara will passel on that large piece of the chotem, that whole upward sloping area. Another subcategory of Shema would be Bletlach. Bletlach are scabs that are caused by punctures, and then it sort of grew over itself, over that puncture wound. So Mariel says that that is Shini Maris, like a Chazazis, and the same halachas will be a problem. And if you have Bletl on the Chotem, it will be Asur even B'mashu. However, we don't pass it like that. Rather, we pass it like Shemus Hadeshen, that a Bletl is considered a Mara Esrog, and therefore it's okay, even if the Bletl would be on Rov, not so common, or even if the Bletl would be on the Chotem, very common, it will still be kosher. That's how we are making. Let's talk about green. Yorok Kikarti is Pasul. Why is Yorok Kikarti Pasul? It's Machlokas. The Bach says, because green is a Shini Mara. It's not a Mara Esrog. It's a Shini Mara. The Magen Avraham says, no, it's nothing to do with Shini Mara. The Magen Avraham says, because if it's green, it's not Nigmar HaPri. That means it was pulled off the tree before it was ready to be pulled off the tree. So it's not Nigmar HaPri. Therefore, I think maybe it's Chesaron with Kichatam, I don't remember. But, says Magen Avraham, if it will change, let's say you take it, if it has the capacity to get yellower, even, you know, now that it's off the tree, if it has the capacity to get yellower, that shows that the pre was Nigmar. This is one of the pet peeves of Rabbi Schechter. He's very mach, even though the Hasidim are very into green and strong, because the Zohar says green is good. But Rabbi Schechter says that that's not what the Zohar means. When the Zohar says Yarok, when the Zohar says Yarok, Yarok doesn't mean green. Yarok in Chazal means yellow. So Yarok Ikarti means green. So that's why Rabbi Schechter is not bothered by the Zohar. And there are those who are very mach when it comes to green, and even a little green, which actually doesn't, you know, it's not so into. So if you ever buy a green esrog, never show it to Rav Schechter. I mean, I've seen this happen many times. Like, people buy a beautiful esrog, and somebody else sold it for $150, and it is perfectly clean. They bring it to Rav Schechter, so they're like, oh, it's pasul gamur. And meanwhile, Rav Schechter will walk into a store and take, like, six esrog in, like, 42 seconds by looking at them like, oh, okay, looks good, and those who'll be fine with, you buy a $150 one, and it has a little green on it, he'll just, you know, say it's possible. So it's important to be aware, you know, for those of you who hang out here between Yom Kippur and Sukkot. Okay, let's move on to the lulav. Nechelka ha-tiyomes, if the tiyomes is split, is a machlokas, a very important machlokas, rishonim, whether the psul of nechelka ha-tiyomes, if the rove of all the leaves have to have this psul of nechelka, that's the only time that a lulav is puzzle, which is basically you'll never have a puzzle lulav. Or the rush, which we are machmir for, that we're worried even if the middle leaf is nechelka, that's already a concern. The Ramah, the Shulchan Aruch is mekel that says the only time there's a psul of nechelka tiyomus is if all the rove of the leaves are nechelka. And the Ramah, Ashkenazim are machmir, as long as the middle leaf is split, that's already a problem. How much split? Well, Rav Rishon would say it's only a psul if the rove of the leaf, meaning from the shedra, where the shedra ends, till the tip, if rove of that is split, that's a psul. But the Ran quotes Yesh Omer, who's machmir, even on nechelka b'miyuto. And what does the word miyuto mean? The Mishabru quotes a chayadna, miyuto means even a mashahu. Which is why it takes time to look for a good lulav, to be machmir for that mashahu. The Mishabru does say, the grah, that you're going to be machmir for the miyuto, for whatever reason. Fine. If there is nechelka tiyomis, it's a machlokas. If it's that's a psul of chaser or hider. So you're going to have a sex feka again on the rest of, on the latter 7 days, the latter 6 days of Sukkot. You can have the same sex feka that we said earlier. Maybe it's only the middle leaf. Maybe it's all the leaves. Even if you say it's only the middle leaf, maybe it's only a psul of. I'm sorry, I take that back. You'll have a sex feka. Maybe it's only a psul of chaser and a psul on the first day. Maybe it's hader. And even if you say it's hader, maybe the psul of hader only applies on the first day, so you would be able to use a lulav that's nechelka tiyomes on the rest of Sukkot. Lulav kafuf, if it's bent over, there's a machlokas, if it's on the shedra, if the shedra is bent, or is there even possible if the leaves are bent? What we call a knepel. Knepel is, you know, lulav is perfectly straight lulav, and right when it gets to very, 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 very tippy top, they sort of curve over like a hook, sort of, like a hook on the very, very tip of the top. So the Rush says that's great, and if you have that, you could be assured that's not going to be nechelka tiyomis. It's a great investment. However, the Ran says that it's pasul mamish, and therefore we have a funny situation. A knepel is a hider for the Rosh and pasul for the Ran. Let's just finish off this shiur talking about hadasim. Hadasim have to be mishulash, and we have machlokas what the word mishulash means. Does it have to come out of the same exact point in the stem? That's a tremendous chumra of Rashi. Rashi says the three leaves must be coming out of the same exact point on the stem, but toes and the Rosh are makel as long as they're smuchim udvukim. Great. What's samuch v'davuk? So the Chazon Ish is famous to have said that let's say you take a string and you run it around the branch. If the three leaves, the point where they connect the leaf to the stick, to the branch, that point that there's like a, there's a thickness to, I don't know, what should we call it, the stem of that. You have the long branch, you have the stem of the leaf, and the leaf comes out of that stem. If you could draw a string around the big branch, and that string will cross all three stems of each leaf, even though one is a little bit higher than the other, that would be considered mishulash. That's how the Chazon Ish explains Tosfos and the Rosh. We do pass like Tosfos and the Rosh, that would be okay. You don't have to have it coming exactly out of the same exact point, which is almost impossible to find. That would be, there's a lot of money in growing hadassim, I'll tell you that much. Those of you who know about aleph, olives, wow. Okay. So, when we want to get mishulash bikulo, when we want to get mishulash, how much of this branch has to be mishulash? So the geonim say it has to be mishulash bekulo. That means if there's one kan, one level of these leaves coming out of this the branch is not mishulash, it's pasul. That's an incredible chumra. That's almost impossible to find. The Rambam says the opposite, a tremendous kula. As long as there's one kan that is mishulash, that's sufficient. We hold middle sheet to other Rishonim that L'chatchil should try to get all of them at the same point, coming out at the same point, but as long as there's one, that would be kasher. Okay, we finished the Shir and Talminim.
Who's the first opinion?
The Gaonim. Do you want to dive in Mincha in the middle or at the end? At the end, you want to go? Let's take a vote. Who wants to daven mincha? Let's say after one more shiur, daven mincha. Who wants to daven mincha at 2:30? Okay, I'll ask the question again in 20 minutes. Says the next shiur. Next shiur is Rabbi Konigsberg's shiur on Hilchas Sukkah. So we know that a sukkah, machlokes if it's has to be a rai or keva. We paskin that it has to be a rai. Arai means that the walls could be made from, of course, you're learning sukkah, I don't have to tell you, so we could skip that. However, Tosfos on the bottom of Amud Aleph, Beis Amud Aleph, points out that even if you say that Arai, the walls could be Arai in the Schach, Tosfos asks the question, if a sukkah that's Arai, you could make it, even if it's kosher, even if you make it keva, as long as it could be Arai, as long as the shoe is Arai, so why would rain be a simon klala? After all, you could make a sukkah keva. You could make a sukkah keva, and as long as it's in a height that could be a rai, it should be kosher. Tosfos says that no. Walls could be a rai in the sense of shir lios a rai, even if they're made out of steel reinforced concrete. But the schach has to be a rai mamish. And therefore, if you had planks on top and you tied together and didn't allow any rain inside, that would be a violation of that would not be arai, and therefore it must be that that would be pasul, and that's why rain would be a simon klala. Let's talk about the size of a sukkah. So, three-way machlokas. Machlok Beishameh says 7x7. That's how we ask Paskin-like, right? Right, we pass on Beishamai here. Beisil says 6x6, right? Beishamai says Rosh HaVerubo and the Shulchan. Beisil says no, just Rosh HaVerubo without the Shulchan, only 6x6. And Rebbe holds that it has to be Dalet Amos by Dalet Amos. We pass one of the Yidches Dvarim, like Beishamai, that 7x7 is the shear for us, the minimum shear for a sukkah. Let's now talk about What does it mean that you don't have to have four walls, nor do you have to have three full walls? You could even have two full and a little bit of a third. So there are a few limitations. It's only if those two walls that you have, those two full walls, are an L shape. If they are parallel to one another, you do not have the heter of shtank hilchas on shlish tefil tefach. Next, besides it being an L shape, the additional tefach must be lavud to one of those walls. By having it lavud, you have a tefach. With the lavud, you have already a rov wall, because if seven is the minimum wall, so what's rov of seven? 3.6? So if you have lavud, which is, let's say, 2.9, and then you have a tefach, you have 3.9. So you already have a rov of a wall. That's why it's sort of a misnomer. It's not a shlish safilu tefach, that it's really more than a tefach. It's really a shlish safilu rov of the minimum shear of a wall. It ends up being using the lavud. That tefach board ends up with the lavud to be close to 3.9. And thirdly, if you do that shlish safil tefach, you also have to make a tzuras ha-pesach above the small wall, meaning between the end of the, you have the lavud, again you have the L, then you have a little bit of lavud, 2.9 of lavud, then you have a tefach, and then you need a tzuras ha-pesach till the end of the empty wall. Those are the parameters for a shlish safil tefach. So a lot of people think, right, every kid comes home from fourth, third grade and says, oh, you don't really need four walls, you only need three walls, you just need 2.5 walls. It's harder than it sounds. Let's talk about canvas. Let's talk about being someich al davar ha-mekabel tumah. Specifically an issue with canvas sukkahs, which are made out of a metal rim. So the Mishnah talks about someich sukkaso Bikari Hamita. And the Mishnah says, Samech Sukkasa Bikari Hamita, it's a machlokas. Tanakama says, Kachama says it's kosher. Yehuda says it's pasul. Okay, what's wrong with being Samech Sukkasa Bikari Hamita? So, some Rishonim say, because, I don't know if it's Rishonim or the Gemara. It might be Amaran. Samech Sukkasa, Rav Yehuda might pass, again, Tanakama says it's kosher. Yehuda passes it because it's, either it's Ein Lakava, right, it could be removed. Or it's Ma'amid B'davar HaMekabel Tumah. What is this psul? So let's back up. The Tanakhama says you're allowed to be Samech Sukkaso. Rabbi Yehuda says you can't be Samech Sukkaso B'Kari Hamita. What's the problem with being Samech Sukkaso B'Kari Hamita? It's Machlokas either if it's Ein Lakeva, nothing to do with Tumah, or because being Ma'amid B'davar HaMekabel Tumah. And what's the problem that being Mamed B'davar HaMekabel Tumah? Why is Mamed a problem? So there's also Machlokas. The Ran says, because the Gzera that you might think if you're going to be Someh B'davar HaMekabel Tumah, you might also think you're allowed to be Mesachech B'davar HaMekabel Tumah. The word Gzera, it's a Gzera you might come to think that you will. That's called an Issa D'Rabbanan. Rashi says no. That if you're going to be Mamed with Mekabel Tumah, being Mamed is just the same as what holds up your schach is davar mekabel tumah. As though your schach is davar mekabel tumah. Why am I telling you that there are so many steps here? The reason why I'm telling you that is because in order to say that there's actually a psul of being mamid davar mekabel tumah, listen to all the steps you have to go through. You have to paskin like Rabbi Yehuda, who's machmir in the Mishnah, not like Shulchan Aruch. In order to be machmer for Rabbi Yehuda, you have to go not like the Shulchan Aruch, right? Who passes that you're allowed to be Sayach B'Kari Hamita. So you have to say, like Rabbi Yehuda, that it's Sayach B'Kari Hamita is a puzzle. And you also have to hold a different machlokas that the problem is not because of Ein Lakeva, but because it's Ma'amid B'davar HaMekabel Tumah. And even within Ma'amid B'davar HaMekabel Tumah, it's machlokas whether it's an Issa D'Oraisa or Issa D'Rabbanan. So if you want to be machmir by davar hamekabel ma'amid b'davar hamekabel tumah, you're going to have to be machmir in all those different sveikas. Halacha l'maisa, the Shulchan Aruch says that you're allowed to be ma'amid b'kari hamita. So it sounds like the Shulchan Aruch holds that there's no problem being ma'amid b'davar hamekabel tumah. Therefore, you can put your schach straight onto the metal bars. The problem is there's a Shulchan Aruch elsewhere, which the Magen Avraham cites as a stira. Because Shulchan Aruch elsewhere presents, not as halacha, but as a suffix, if you're allowed to rest the schach on top of a ladder. Why is he mesopek? So Magen Avraham says he's mesopek because whether or not you're allowed to be mesachek on davar hamekabel tuma. I don't understand. How come here he's mesopek and there he was sure? So Magen Avraham suggests that lichatchila you should be machmir. Magen Avraham suggests that the Shulchan Aruch himself was mesopek. Therefore, lichatchila the Shulchan Aruch says you should be machmir and not be mamid the davar hamekabel tuma. But b'diavad, if you had a sukkah that is built on mamid davar hamekabel tuma, it would be kosher. The Chazanish, of course, had his tremendous chumra that even mamid to mamid is a problem. But Rav Shechter likes to point out, as I just pointed, all the different steps to be machmir, Rav Chazanish was makel on an earlier step. The Chazanish was already makel, even that mamid is totally okay. But if you would hold that mamid, the Dhamma Kalatum is a problem, which the Chazanish himself doesn't hold, but if you would hold that it's a problem, then the Chazanish says a mamid to mamid would still be a problem. Let's go on. Let's talk now about mats being used for schach. The two potential issues that could arise is A, that maybe the mat is in the Kabbal Tumah, and B, there's a Gzera D'Rabbanan, Gzera's Tikra. So let's talk about one at a time. So the Mishnah says explicitly that Machzeles, a mat, if it's the Shchiva, it's the Kabbal Tumah, and it's possible if it's the Sikuch, it's not a Kabbal Tumah, and it's Kasher. So let's assume that nowadays all the mats that we buy were manufactured by people who subcontracted the Chinese guy and definitely did it for the Sikuch, because you could charge a lot more money if you sell it to Jews with Sikuch than if you stam or buying a mat for like $4 at a, I don't know what store. Okay, what about Gzeres Tikra? What's that issue? So Gzeres Tikra is a problem of putting planks instead of thin, narrow slats as your schach, but wider planks. What are the shiurim? Let's talk about that, how wide is wide. So Machlokes Tanan, if you're allowed, everyone agrees that if you use a plank that's 4 tefachim wide, that's going to be something called Gzeres Tikra. It looks like a roof. If you use something less than 3 tefachim, that everyone agrees is okay. And between 3 and 4 tefachim, that's Machlokes. But what are we talking about when we talk about a mat? We're talking about a mat that's many more than 4 tefachim wide, but they're made out of thin parts that altogether are more than 4 tefachim wide. So is that like a 4 tefachim wide plank, which is a problem? Or is it like just a lot of little slats, which are not a problem? So here the Rashba says that if you attach narrow planks to each other to make them more than 4 tefachim wide, that would be a problem. According to that Rashba, Rav Yashu was takam machmir, at least in the first edition, Rav Yashu is takam machmir, assumes that mats would be a problem, because Mamash would like this Rashba, that it's a Gzeres Tikra, because you're taking little pieces together to make a sum total of more than 4 tefachim wide. However, most poskim disagree in our makel and say that no, our mats would not have a Gzeres Tikra on them, first of all, because they're not like a roof. A, because rain goes through it. Maybe the Rashba is only machmir if they're tight and like a plank, like a real plank that doesn't allow water through. B, it's very flimsy, it's not like a real roof. 3, our mats are made out of bamboo and nobody in Teaneck or the Five Towns or Chicago or LA makes roofs out of bamboo. So for these reasons, many poskim, most people are maker with when it comes to mats. As far as holding those mats together with string is mekabel tumah. String might be made out of plastic, so it also might be mamid bedavar hapasol because it's not kedula karka. But if they use hemp is natural. It's gidul min hakarka, and if it's not made into string, it's just kept as long fibers, so it's not a kli, it's not a mekabel tumah either. Okay, let's talk about canvas sukkahs. We mentioned earlier the first problem that a canvas sukkah potentially could have, that's that you lie the stock on metal, which again could be solved if you put an intermediate chatzitza between the metal beams, the metal rods, and the schach. The second issue is what we'll talk about right now, and that's tasev lomen ha'asui, because it's very easy when you make a metal sukkah to put up the frame, then put the schach on, and then afterwards to make the walls. That should theoretically be a problem of tasev lomen ha'asui. That's what the Ramah says. The Ramah says that you have to make sure first you put on walls and then put on the staff. And thirdly, we'll speak about right now, is the walls made out of canvas blow in the wind, and what could be the problem with that? So Gemara tells us that a mechitza she'ena omedes beruch mitzuya is not called a mechitza at all. The question is, how much is it moving? So we assume that if it's more than three tefachim from its original location, that such that there's no longer lavud, that will be a problem. So again, what happens all the time is you have to, is it three tefachim total? No, I think three tefachim from its original location. That means that it could have a leeway, you know, from you know, on a curve you have an x-axis. So you have the top of the curve and the bottom of the curve, above the axis and below the axis. So from that point to that point, what do we call that? There's a word. Some statistics person, no? Did any of you go to college? What?
Y-intercept?
No. If you have a wave, no, right? The wave has the high point?
Crest.
The crest, thank you. So if you have the upper crest and the lower crest?
Drop,
thank you. There we go. This guy went to college. Okay. So it's good to have at least one. That's fine. So if you have from crest to crest, six tefachim, that would be, whatever, 5.9 tefachim, that's okay. We're not talking about three tefachim from crest to trough. We're just tilting it 90 degrees. We're not talking about three tefachim from crest to trough. We're talking about three tefachim from the original position and three tefachim this way from the original position. So it's going to be 5.9. If it's billowing, 5.9 tefachim, that's where we're going to have the problem. That's how I understood it. But hey, what happens if you tie it down really, really strong and it's not going to blow in the wind? So should that be okay? I would think so. However, Rabbeinu Peretz says you should not use tzedinim even if you tie them very tightly and they don't move, because gzeirat dilma mintaki. Maybe they will get unattached and they will blow. So if you're worried for that, Rabbeinu Peretz, that the Shulchan Aruch quotes, then the only way to be matir a canvas sukkah. Is even if it's held tight, that we're still worried about it, is if you put, you know, strings or bands, the newer sukkahs have that, around the poles, loved one to another, so that you have the mechitza created by those successive bands or strings on the bottom, so you have a mechitza. I think Shechta suggested that when you have a canvas sukkah, we're not worried about this Shulchan Aruch that says that it might become loose because it's made to be tied. It has grommets. Grommets are those little metal circles that you tie the strings to. That's made to be tied up. Then we're not worried that it's going to get untied. That's fine. Those are the issues with canvas sukkahs. When it comes to schach pasul, it's important to remember the schach pasul is pasul only with four tefachim wide, while avir is pasul with, anyone learning sukkah this year? Three tefachim wide. Very good. Also, a difference between schach pasul and avir is that if it's less than four tefachim of schach pasul, you're allowed to sit under it. You can sit under the schach pasul. So therefore, if you have a metal, a light fixture that's less than four tefachim wide, which many of them can be, you could mamish sit under the schach pasul, under that metal light. Avir, on the other hand, even if it's less than three tefachim, you're not supposed to sit under that avir. Maybe because the Mishnah Berurah says that avir has these two chumras, maybe because it's more nikar. But the Rashi asks a very simple question. If you're not allowed to sit under the avir, well, there's always a little bit of avir that you're sitting under. So shouldn't that be a problem? So the Rashi says, no, the only problem that avir, even less than three tefachim, is a problem to sit under, is if it's avir al panei kulo. It's from side to side. There's a straight, if you have all the bamboo going one direction, bamboo, 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 so you can have a straight line of air between bamboo sticks. So it says, according to the Rashi, it would be very intelligent to do what? To take one beam and put it perpendicular to the rest of the schach, so that there's no point on your sukkah that there's avir min hakatze al hakatze, and therefore, the avir won't mess you up, won't have the psul of sitting under avir. And then, of course, you all know this something called Dofen Akuma, and we're not going to talk about that. Okay. You want to daven Mincha now or later?
For now.
Who wants to daven now? Who wants to daven later? Okay, we'll daven later. Let's talk about the next year. You could all stretch. We could take a 30-second stretch if you want. Okay. So the next year is Rabbi... That was a hard one. Let's do an easier one now. Okay, let's talk about Bris Mila first. That was a little bit of a lighter shear. Let's talk about Bris Mila. This we'll be able to do relatively quickly. So, tell this shear on Bris Mila. Why is Mila considered a mitzvah gedola? Mishar mitzvah, as the Shulchan Aruch says. What way is it gedola? So maybe it's because it has its hakaris. Maybe it's because it was a mitzvah that was given to the first Jew. Maybe because if a person doesn't fulfill the mitzvah is transported, I don't know what word, is given over, is handed over to, what's the word?
Transmitted,
thank you, to from the father to the base of the community, that could be, fine. Rabbi Tendler is very strong in his opinion that mitzitza is not a chelek of the bris milah. That's what Rabbi Tendler holds. I don't think everybody holds like that. But in his opinion as such, in his understanding of the Gemara, that the only reason to do a mitzitza is to, as a refuah, after, and he assumes that the mila itself is only the mila and the priya, and not the mitzitza. So mitzitza is only because of sakana. He assumes what comes out of that logic would be that if we assume that you don't have to do it for medicinal purposes, and mitzitza is not necessary for medicinal purposes, it should be also to do on Shabbos, because the dam, if you're sucking the blood out, that's going to be an issa d'oraisa, and if he's assuming that's not a chelik of mila, but it's for medicinal purposes, and you assume that it's nowadays not necessary for medicinal purposes, he would assume that you're not allowed to do a mitzitza on Shabbos, which, between you and me, would be unlike any moho you've ever met in your life. But he assumes that he doesn't understand why mitzitza should be permitted on Shabbos based on his logic. Let's talk about something called hypospadia. Hypospadia is a situation that is a medical situation where the opening for the urine at the tip of the aver is not at the very end, it's not at the tip, but it's a little bit below the tip. It doesn't get the tube, the ending of the tube doesn't get all the way till the end of the aver. So there are certain situations where the doctors will say, "Hey, let's wait a little while until we could do some surgery to reroute the urethra, I think it's called, the urinary tube, to get it to the proper space where it is." So is that a reason enough to warrant delaying the bris milah after the eighth day and potentially incurring kares to allow this? Again, it might not be a medical need, but there could be a psychological need. So Rabbi Tendler, the way he sort of gave the pshara was that if it's such that the only way this young boy would be able to go to the bathroom, obviously he's a baby right now, he's 7 days old, but if it's situated on the bottom part of the aver, so far away from the tip that he would only, even as a grown-up, be able to urinate sitting down like a woman, that would be something that they should wait and delay the bris till he's 2 years old to do the appropriate surgeries. If, on the other hand, he could urinate and it goes forward and be able to urinate a urinal normally, but it might just, okay, instead of going straight ahead, it goes on a 20-degree angle, 30-degree angle, 40-degree angle, because it's not exactly at the tip, that he felt would not warrant delaying a bris and incurring potential caries for that kind of mild hypospadia. Then Rabbi Tendler discussed the different clamps. I'm not going to get into there's a Gamko, there's a Bronstein, there's a Mugain. I guess when you get your Shemush in Mila, you'll have the opportunity to discover the intricacies of all of those. I mean, the main issue of why some of the clamps are not accepted by Poskim is that there are certain clamps, specifically the one that's used by the hospitals, which I think is the Gamko. Did you say yes? Great, thank you. That it seals the blood, it stops the blood in that immediate area, so that even after the cut happens, there's no blood coming out, so there's no dam mila, and therefore that would be a problem if it was done. So that's why poskim don't like the use of the gamkel, which is what the hospitals typically use. Next point is tsar hamila. Is it appropriate or not appropriate to use anesthesia of sorts on a baby? So the Medrash tells us, Medrash Rava tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that Avram is nimo be'etzem himazeh, hirgish mitzar kadei sheyichpo lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu schara, etc., etc. So based on that Medrash, that Chazal, that Avram Avinu got more schar because of the tsar that he incurred through the Bris Mila, many have the tradition that you should not use an anesthetic. Rav Tanda does not like that logic because he says just because you have a Chazal that says that Avram wanted it, chose to make get more schar for himself, that's a choice somebody has the right to make. But for me to impose my wanting my baby to get more schar and therefore my wanting to impose tsar on my baby, that Rabbi Tanda felt was not the father's prerogative, and therefore Rabbi Tedler's estimation and aesthetic would be and should be and could be used.
I don't think
people use anesthetics, but again, for 8-day-old babies, I think they assume that the nervous system might just not be sufficiently developed to be too painful. Whenever you see, I have a lot of bristles because I've sit up in front and the baby is usually crying. You know, once they open up his clothes because he's cold. So there's a mole in my neighborhood who's very smart. After you hear the baby crying, wow, all the ladies are like cringing. And then he says, okay, I got the baby ready for the bris, and whatever. Now it's a good ace rotzon to dam. He says something like that. He's not trying to tell you that it's a good ace rotzon to dam. He's just trying to tell you that whenever you heard the baby crying, it's just, he was cold or whatever. I didn't even start anything yet. So it's a very smart thing to do. Is that? Rabbi Pesach Kron's son. He lives in my neighborhood, so I think he says that. Okay. Okay, one important thing in Hilchas Mila is that if a baby is a chola, it's not just enough to wait until the baby is chola to secede, to end, but rather you have to wait 7 days me'es leis. That means if a baby today, the doctor clears him at 4 p.m. today, that means next Tuesday you have to give him bris at 4 p.m. Not before 4 p.m., but it's also tricky because it can't be after 4:28 p.m. because that's when you're going to be after Shkia. So if that would be to be the case, you would have to do the bris next week at 4 o'clock, between 4 and 4:28 for Shkia next week, to get the bris on time. Rabbi Tendler felt strongly about not being happy with Molim who say, I don't want to do a bris mila on a baby below a certain weight. Because underweight is, if you're sick, then you have to wait a week. Nobody says for an underweight baby you have to wait a week. You say it has to be at a certain weight. So if we assume that, according to medicine, there's no problem with a certain weight, 4 pounds, or whatever it is. Medically, there's no problem with a 4-pound baby. The numbers are less important than the idea. So why would there be a mole? Why should a mole say, I don't want to do bris mila in any baby less than 5 pounds? If he's a chola, so he has a din chola, he'd have to wait a week anyway. If he doesn't have a din chola, so what are you making up? That you don't want to do a bris mila? If the doctor says, I remember my son was in the NICU. Right? My Bukhar went to the hospital. It was my first time in a car on Shabbos, actually. First time. Took him to the hospital when he was 3 days old, right? He had his Shalom Zachar that night. The next morning, he had a fever. So that's why I tell people when they have Shalom Zachars, don't parade the baby around. So everybody, oh, what a cute baby. It's not good for anybody. So we took him to the hospital on Shabbos. And it was my Bechar, and obviously I never made a bris before, and we were wondering, when. So I asked the head of, I was in Hadassah and Karen. And I asked the head of pediatrics there, will I be able to do a bris on time? He said, listen, as far as doctors are concerned, we could do open heart surgery on a 1-day-old baby. It's the rabbis who are worried about it. So, they weren't worried. So again, halacha is 7 days waiting after chol is over. That's what we do. Rabbi Tanner was wondering, if it's not considered a danger under 4 pounds or 4.5 pounds, so why is the mohel making you violate an issa kares because he doesn't want to do it. But Chazal are fighting. Where does that come from? So get yourself another mold. That's what he suggested. Similarly, when it comes to Billy Rubin, again, Moalim say, I don't do bris milas unless I'm 12. But again, as I tell the point that Billy Rubin is a moving target. Billy Rubin changes every single few hours, every day, every few hours, and there's no, you know, because a doctor, even though doctors assume that there's no problem with Billy Rubin as long as it's below 18 or 19. So why would a Moal say, I don't want to do anything with a Billy Rubin above 12? Again, if medically there's no problem with it, and you're pushing off a bris after the 8th day, so why are you causing a chiv kari? So it's something that the doctors say there's no problem with. I'm trying to think about. As far as delaying a Shabbos bris, because you know a family member will drive on Shabbos to the bris, so Rav Moshe said that not to delay a bris. And tell himself though, maybe as far as why that be otherwise, Rav Moshe paskin that you wouldn't delay a bris, even if somebody will end up driving. I never looked at that shuvah, but that's worth looking at. Interesting point. Mila balayla is ma'akev. It's not considered bris, and he's hatav as dam bris. Fascinating. Okay. Important to know that even after, God forbid, if there's a stillborn birth, baby dies or a bayo nefel, we do mila on the baby based on the medrash that said that Avraham Avinu stands up Hitzla Shel Gehenna to keep anyone who's not gemalt out, but we don't do it on Shabbos Yontif, Mesa's Mukta, and obviously he doesn't need a mohel to do that. What about a guy doing? What about doing a bris mila, a circumcision to a guy? So the Ramah is explicitly Asr Lamol Guy. Based on the Gemara, Avodah Zarah says we don't heal Goyim. Well, if that's the case, says the Shach, if the only reason to do it is for healing the guy, so I hear. But if the reason for you to do it is because you want to make money, Parnasa, so says the Shach, if it's for Schach, that might be okay. The issue will be that nowadays it's not just like, so again, so if you want to go to Eretz Yisrael and practice on Arab children, so you're doing it just for Schach. But if you're a doctor, an intern, if you're a pediatric, whatever, one of these, pediatrician, I guess, or a OBG who does circumcisions in America, you're not doing it because they're Arabs. You're doing it because the American Medical Association suggests and urges people to get circumcised for medical reasons. So maybe you are doing lirafua. So maybe that should tackle your problem. Yes, you're getting money for it, but what's motivating you to do it is the lirafua component. So that's something that you should think about if you do go into the field. As far as Shachianu is concerned, I don't think he spoke about that this year. Rav Tendler also had an interesting idea as far as again, going back to the Mitzitza point, a Mitzitza V'Peh, Mitzitza V'Shabbos, assuming, which is I think a fair assumption, that Mitzitza nowadays does not have any medical value, and Tendler pointed out that you could prove that. Why? Because nowadays you have millions and millions of Goyim who have a circumcision without Mitzitza, and they seem to be doing fine. So that's a proof that, you know, because some of the Achronim say that if there's a Safek and something that's for Pikuach Nefesh, you have to do it until you, because you can't prove that mitzitza is not necessary. But Rabbi Tana said, for now that you can prove that mitzitza is not necessary, because you have millions of people who don't have mitzitza and they're fine. So because of that, Rabbi Tendler would assume that if you don't really need it, so certainly don't do a pepeh if there's any risk involved. Is there risk involved? There are many articles that have been written. I'm not going to, you know, preach to the choir about that. And again, like I said before, on Shabbos, Rabbi Tendler assumes you shouldn't do mitzitza on Shabbos. Okay, now let's go to the shir of Arkos, Rabbi Reese's shir of on Beis Din and Arkos. Our time is up. Let's see how many shirs we have. A good few shir left.
We're up to
6
now?
Yeah.
5.
Okay.
14?
13.
14.
Is it
14
Shuler? That was 6 out of 13
Shuler.
It
was
5.
Okay. Two bris milas, and mezuzah is also two. Okay, so we did about half. Let's speed through one more. I'm going to have to stop. Let's do electricity on Shabbos. Okay, electricity on Shabbos. So it's important to realize that whenever you discuss the issue of electricity, I will ask that right after we'll start mincha, immediately after this shir, right away. So if you do have to use the bathroom, please use it while I'm talking. Electricity on Shabbos. So you have to realize that when we talk about the permissibility of electricity, we're only talking about electricity per se. If you're turning on an incandescent light bulb, so besides electricity, you also have the issue of havara. If you're turning on a microwave, besides the issue of electricity, you also have the issue of bishul. If you're turning on a tractor, besides the issue of electricity, you also have the issue of choresh or kotzer. So we're only talking about the electricity per se. What is the issue of electricity? Keep in mind, when we talk about whatever issue we'll mention in the next minute or two, it could be, we're going to mention different opinions, and they might all be right. It could be three totally different issurim, all present and independently usur and contributing to a multifaceted isur of, you know, isur, multi-isur in using electricity. But the first opinion was the Aruch HaShulchan, which says that it's a havara, there's fire in the wires, when the wires come together, the fire comes al hapoel, and therefore, if it's fire, therefore it's mutar on yantif, electricity will be mutar on yantif. We don't hold like that. There's no fire in the walls, you're not allowed to use electricity on yantif, nothing to talk about. Let's talk about the opinion of the Chazon Ish, which is what most of the avoda of the shir was. Chazon Ish, I think, made 2 points. Chazon Ish assumes that there would be an issur d'oraisa to use electricity for in any which way. Connecting a circuit would be an issur d'oraisa for two possibilities. And again, Rabbi Packer did an exceptional job showing that these are lumdisha issues, not just balabatisha issues. Number one is we know that ein binyan bekelim. Yesh binyan bekaka, but ein binyan bekelim. Says the Chazon Ish, hey, if you're taking this item and plugging it into the wall, maybe that's considered binyan bekarka. And that would be asa d'oraisa. Point number one. Point number two. We know that ein binyan bekelim. However, if you have, Tosis tells us that if you have a binyan bekli, that you make the kli from A to Z, it's not just that you connected the two parts of the, you know, the top of the standard to the bottom of the standard. No, you said, you started this morning with nothing here, and now at the end of the Shabbos you have a full standard, A to Z, then we do say binyan bekelim. Suggested Rebbe the Chazon Ish, as Rabbi Packer, with Rabbi Packer's explanation, when you take something that's you take a fan, piece of plastic and metal, that's not doing anything, that's meaningless. All of a sudden, you connect the circuit, you turn it on, you click on the switch. What did you just do? You gave a meaningless scrap of metal and plastic to turn into a fan, a purposeful fan. That might be considered binyan v'kelim from A to Z. That's giving something that's absolutely meaningless to have something so purposeful, so useful. That might be considered binyan v'kelim from A to Z, and therefore would, yes, be yesh binyan v'kelim, because it's that second type of binyan that's binyan from A to Z, and therefore there would be an Isser of Binyan, Bekelim. And thirdly, I don't remember if this is part of this previous point or a dependent point, even if you hold Ein Binyan Bekelim, if you have something that is a firm connection called Tika, that is considered Makeh B'Patish. So when you connect a circuit, don't look at it with your physical eyes, your balabatisha eyes, that you're connecting two things really strong with a screwdriver. No, that's not the point. But you connect a circuit, and it's a meaningful connection because it's making something work now. It takes something that is useless, and now it's working. So that's the electricity, the current going through it, makes it, gives it life. So what you just did is that you connected something, so it's connected firmly, not physically that it's screwed in, but that would halachically be considered, lamdishly, that would be considered tika, a firm connection, because it's a meaningful connection. Not firm physically, but firm in the sense that it was a significant act, that it did something purposeful, and therefore that would be considered tika. And therefore, on all these counts, the Chazon Ish would hold, I don't know if all these would get you an issur d'oraisa, but either way, the Chazon Ish holds that between some of these or all of these, you have an Isser Doraisa. The Rabbi Shlomo Zalman, of course, is famous. How old is he? 21, 23-year-old tshuva to the, discussion about for his mother's hearing aid, rejects the Chazon Ish and says, no, it's not bona. Let's take one at a time. It's not bona b'mechuber, because in the same way you could open and close a door, that's not called bona b'mechuber. Why not? Because that's darkah. It's supposed to be open and close, open and close, open and close. So too, if you have a switch, you turn on, off, on, off, on, off, on, off, that's also not going to be. And a door is mamish mechuber. So too, something that you're turning an electrical appliance, that you're turning on and off. That's darko b'kach, just like closing and opening a door. So it's darko b'kach, to open and close, that's not called bona b'mechuber. Along similar logic, you want to say that it's takat, such a firm connection, because it's so meaningful, as we explained, but in the same way you flick the thing on, you could just as easily flick the thing off. So how can you call that takat? A firm, strong connection. You just flick the switch on, you can flick it to ease just the, in the same place, in the opposite direction. So therefore, again, obviously there's a lamed shemachlokas going on here between the Chazon Ish and the Shlomo Zalman, whether that, the fact that even you could flick it on and off easily, so Shlomo Zalman says that shows that it's not tzakah, and the Chazon Ish perhaps might be saying, again, I'm, explaining the Chazon Ish's response, what he might respond, is that no, the fact that the electricity is making it meaningful, even though it's not it is weak and you could just flick it back and forth, but the Chazon Ish might still say, yes, that is. Making it alive might give it that chashivus to be as considered tzakah. Halacha l'maisa, between you and me, don't ever tell this to your balabatim. Most poskim assume, certainly the poskim in YU, assume the halacha, like Rav Shlomo Zalman, that electricity is also drabbanan. But it's not to be taken lightly. However, when you have cases of cholim and other stuff like that, and shinuis and cholim, that's where you keep this to yourself, and there might be situations of tziruf from the hakel. Rav Asher Weiss suggested a brilliant mahalach to show why, indeed, like the mahalach, like the svara of the Chazon Ish, why even though you're not doing anything so significant physically, it could still be considered makeh b'patish. Because he found the Yerushalmi that says that when the Amoraim were looking for the toldos of the avos malacha, they found each one was corresponding to each toldo corresponding to each av, and the toldos that they couldn't pin to a specific av, they pinned on makeh b'patish, which is a mind-blowing discovery, because what that means is that the Chachamim's starting point is not that, oh, I have an Av Malacha, what emanates from the Av Malacha? No. The starting point is Chachamim say, let's look at this act and decide if it should be Aser or Mutter. I decide it should be Aser. Oh, it's Aser? Where should I pin it? If I could pin it on something, great. If I can't pin it on something, I'm going to pin it on Makeh B'Patish. And that would be clearly all the Chachamim throughout the generation since the inception of electricity, since harnessing electricity, all assume that it should be Aser, and therefore it would possibly be Makeh B'Patish on a Doraisa level. It might be also Meduyuk in one of the Ramosha Feinstein's tshuva that he was assuming like this, so it's a svara to take seriously. Shaft's opinion of why electricity is Aser is based on a Gemara that talks about Sinur Sha'alu Balkas Kasin. If you have a pipe that's stuffed up, could you unplug the pipe? It's an Issa D'Rabbanan that if it has a pipe that has, let's say, like leaves or filled with gutter, you want to unplug that. So Rav Shaftu assumes similarly, if you're allowing the electrons to run through the circuit, that would be similar. So that's the paradigm that Rav Shaftu would assume. Others say it's like molded reach, right? Reach is amorphous, but if you put a reach into clothing, you mold a reach into clothing, that's going to be also. So too, if you infuse the electrons into an appliance, that could be a similar, these amorphous electrons also, that might be like molded reach. That's another opinion. Subcategory, that was all as far as what is the Isser electricity. Let's just finish off for a moment, what some subcategories and some applications would be. If you have a semiconductor, meaning like the screen of my phone, which you're not creating a circuit, the circuit's on, you're just allowing more resistance. I'm not a physics person, but you're allowing, by pressing down, you're allowing more or less resistance to the electrical current. There, you're not creating the circuit. So maybe all the Chazon Ish's svara is that you're creating something, you're being bonus something, you're bringing mechaim al ha'mamim, mavis al ha'chaim, all those svaras might fall away when you talk about semiconductors and things like touching your the screen on your phone as long as the phone is on. Similarly, if you're changing the volume or the brightness, that's Shinui Zerim, that also might be more kal. And therefore, if a doctor, for whatever reason, is going to need to use electricity, it's better to have his whatever he has on the whole time and just adjust the settings as he goes. Okay, we'll stop here, and Bez Hashem will figure out a time to have the next session.